It is the State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin egg exports are strong, but for how long? The World Trade Organization forecasts the global economy facing strong headwinds next year. We explore how multiple shocks weigh on the global economy, what it all means for Wisconsin exporters. Join in and how your firm is navigating international markets, what your customers outside the U.S. tell you, and closer to our capital, what trade beneficial policy should lawmakers budget for? 800-642-1234. Mark Rodehage is here, director of the International Agribusiness Center. That's part of the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, where he directs the Export and Business Development Bureau. Mark, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
So Wisconsin egg producers seem to be finding homes for products around the world. Exports last year hitting an all-time high. What is the source of the momentum?
Well, demand is the main part of it. You were correct, $3.94 billion at the end of last year. That was well up from the previous year. And year to date in June, we're up a little over 14% to $2.18 billion. So good half of the year so far, and fairly positive outlook by industry and USDA to finish out the year even stronger than last year. And I think a lot of what's driving that is demand around the world. You know, post-COVID, a lot of stocks need to be refilled, and a few other challenges, as you noted in the intro, that in most cases we're able to produce those products to get them to the markets that need them.
Are agricultural exports up around the country, or is Wisconsin an outlier, do you think?
No, the all U.S. Food, forestry, and agricultural product exports are up. They're actually up around 15%. So we're tracking pretty close to the rest of the U.S. So it's been a pretty strong year so far for agricultural product exports.
When you look at the value of exports, I mean, we see sky high inflation here at home. What does that mean for the value of goods that producers can get for their products outside our borders?
Well, the prices have certainly gone up on things, and inflation has played a part of that. And of course, that also figures into the inputs for those products. I think by and large, what we hear from industry is that things are okay, that they've not certainly impacted by inflation, but not to the point where they're losing so much. And so and they're actually shipping more product as well. So far, so good, so far, so strong.
What impact have the Biden administration's trade policy had? You know, what impact have tariffs had on our biggest trading partners like Canada, like Mexico and China?
Well, certainly in the previous years, the retaliatory tariffs that had been on several agricultural goods were part of what were pushing down our exports. We had some difficult years over the last five, but then moving into post-COVID and then through the start of this year, it's actually been fairly good that a number of those tariffs had been removed actually after the USMCA was signed for Canada and Mexico, and then as well into Europe. There are still some tariffs in China, certainly on products, ginseng being one of the more notable ones, and still difficult for a lot of those folks shipping products into that market. And then into Canada, there is still some challenge with the tariff rate quotas. So the amount of cheese that we're able to sell, we believe, and the industry believes that we would be able to ship more if Canada were to allow more import by distributors and food service buyers as opposed to only the processors, which is that right now. However, I have to say that in Canada and overall, dairy exports are up. So those tariff rate quotas on those dairy products, although would allow for more opportunity, it's still been a fairly strong year to date.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about global trade with Mark Rodehage, director of the state's International Agribusiness Center. You can join in on exports and how your company has fared, where your eye is now, what about inflation and other input costs. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mark, we saw there the World Trade Organization forecasting in recent days that trade will slow significantly next year, increasing just 1% from this year. It previously had expected trade to increase more than 3%. So what would a global trade slowdown mean for Wisconsin egg producers?
Well, it could potentially be a difficult year for us going forward. We look to finish this year out, though, relatively strong, as I mentioned before, a little bit above what last year was. We don't see the forecast quite yet. USDA puts out forecasts later on in this year to be able to help see what the how it might end up for us. But looking through 2023, there certainly are concerns. Demand could potentially fall off, and then as well, the strength of the dollar is probably one of the stronger factors right now. That it's one of those headwinds that you mentioned, pushing against being able to move forward. But at the same time, demand for food products and most of what we produce in agricultural products is expected to remain relatively strong. So haven't seen the forecasts yet from all the economists who do that work, but not maybe as pessimistic as what the WTO is saying across all countries.
Well, on the theme, though, of headwinds, and I think we need to just take stock because there are so many variables to watch that could impact egg exports, the high inflation, the fears of recession, the ongoing war in Ukraine and grain, and then Wall Street volatility and the strength of the dollar. What is the thing that concerns you most?
I think, the cost of the dollar, the or the price of the dollar, I guess, in terms of other currencies, and then the supply chain challenges that we'd seen before. That availability of containers to ship a lot of those completed finished food products, and the costs of fuel to move those products around. So some of those things, I think, are concerns that would push against what we're able to ship. And then what also factors against that that could be to the positive, maybe not for the folks that are growing the products that they're shipping, or some of the weather concerns. So certainly we've had ours here, and we've had some drought conditions around the U.S., but there are also those conditions in other parts of the world, that those the lack of water in the number of markets. And so some of that still factors into needing more of the food products. Now, that may have a different effect for the manufactured products, but the food products seem to be, demand seems to be strong enough in those areas.
Mark Rodehage leads the International Agribusiness Center inside the State Agriculture Department. Join in on our state's egg producers exporting to 146 countries last year over year, double-digit growth from 2020. How your organization views the value of exports as part of its business model. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we discuss Wisconsin export markets, products with the International Agriculture Center housed within the State Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Top three markets for Wisconsin egg exports last year, they were Canada, China, and Mexico. Join in on global trade, how Wisconsin goods fit into the picture, what policy action you want from lawmakers to boost state exports. 800-642-1234. Mark Rodehage directs the International Agribusiness Center, stays with us, also Bureau Director for Export and Business Development. So, Mark, you know, you mentioned supply chain issues and container issues. You know, we still remember last year all those loaded container ships that were congregated off the coast of Southern California. Are you saying that there are still supply chain issues out there?
There are, although those impressive number of ships waiting at sea to come in and be loaded, and some of that overage in containers sitting at the port empty and essentially shipping air back to Asia, those empty containers going back to refill. Some of that's been alleviated, I think, and caught up. But there are still some worries about that. And it's difficult in general for containers to get into Wisconsin. The availability of those containers, they go to the major port areas, they go to some of the major cities. As we hear from companies that we work with and talk to, that it's still difficult to get those containers. They have to wait longer, the price is higher. So a lack of an intermodal facility where those metal boxes, those 20 and 40 foot long boxes are stored and made available still are a challenge. Now, people are able to get them. And some of the companies have resorted to their own solutions, contracting with companies to bring in specialized containers to help move their products. So that still is a concern for a number of folks going forward. Not to the level it was a few months ago, but still a concern.
Canada being Wisconsin's biggest export market, followed by China and Mexico, are there markets where you see room for growth?
Absolutely. And if you look at our top five markets, so besides Canada, China, and Mexico, as you mentioned, or the top three, rather, the top five include Korea and Japan, and they make up nearly two-thirds of our exports. If you go to the top 10, that's like three-quarters of our exports. All of those are up year to date, and we see those staying steady for us, some more so than others. Mexico's had a bit of a challenge with their economy not being as strong as it maybe has been in the past, and COVID hit them quite hard. But as we look at those opportunity points, Korea, quite strong. Japan, China is still strong, even though certainly some challenges and some tensions geopolitically with China, but they still need our goods. A lot of whey products go there, a lot of grain products go there. But then we're also looking at areas like the Middle East. So the Gulf countries, there's a major trade show in Dubai, UAE, but markets like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Qatar, those are all, and the UAE, of course, too, those are all strong areas for us. And in Asia Pacific, Southeast Asia, there's a major trade show that we'll be participating in Thailand that will be from that region.
And I want to pause right there because
sure.
Where is the next trade mission and what are you gearing up for to put Wisconsin on display?
Well, I appreciate that question because the Wisconsin Initiative for Agricultural Exports, that's funding that's from the legislature and authority to provide up to $1 million a year for the next 5 years to grow our ag exports by 25%. Part of that funding goes to grants to companies and organizations, but another part of that is for trade promotion activities. And that includes trade shows. So a pavilion where we facilitate Wisconsin agribusinesses, the dairy, meat, and crop product companies to exhibit their products, to make that easier for them to do that. And then as well, the missions, as you mentioned, so going outbound, traveling with companies to meet their prospective buyers, and then inbound missions. So the next activities that we're looking at for 2023, Gulf Food, as I mentioned, in UAE, that's for a range of finished food products, dairy, meat, and crop. Products, and that's in Dubai in February. In March of 23, That's VIV Asia. That's a livestock and genetics and feed products show. And then we are looking to do a trade mission to the UK. UK is a reasonably well-established market. It's number six for us, I believe, year to date. Has been perennially a strong market. Sometimes it's even reached into the top five. And we're looking to bring companies to that market to meet their potential buyers. That would be in May, June period of the year. And then we have a couple of inbound buyer missions for wood and food products planned. So all of those activities are funded by the Wisconsin Initiative for Agricultural Exports. So those are Wisconsin funding
and I think
that's available for programming.
Yeah, that's an important distinction because your center, as I understand, used to be funded through federal dollars and support from trade organizations. Now you get some state funding. And what does that change enable you to do?
Well, it allows us a couple of things. And it's a both and approach. So we still are working with those funds that come through USDA, through the Food Export Association, livestock, U.S. Livestock Genetics Exports, and as well through Small Business Administration funds. That's through a grant program that actually is channeled through WEDC. So we work quite closely with them on that. So we're continuing to do activities for that as well. But what this specific funding from Wisconsin does for us is that it allows us to then have a bit more control over our destiny, let's say, that we're able to tailor those activities more directly than, let's say, some of the federal programs where food export may be going to a particular market. Still good for us, but now we're able to do things that are completely focused on Wisconsin needs. And then adding to that, one of the grant programs, the export expansion grants, allows for agribusiness organizations or those organizations that benefit dairy, meat, and crop exporters to be able to do those kinds of activities as well themselves. So we're multiplying the effort as well as being able to tailor a number of these activities specifically for Wisconsin needs.
Mark Rodehage stays with us as Director of the Export and Business Development Bureau for the state. You can join in on Global Trade at 800-642-1234. Mark, I want to pause here for a moment and just mention the Export-Import Bank of the U.S. giving loans, lines of credit to help American companies finance their deals and, you know, sometimes assuming risk that the private sector might not. Is Wisconsin using the EXIM Bank services to its fullest potential?
You know, that's a good question and a good point. The EXIM Bank, and a lot of people think of it being the bank for Boeing, that it's only for multi-million dollar deals on massive jets or a number of jets being sold in markets. But actually, EXIM Bank, their programs help small to mid-size exporters as well. And it's across the board, not just for manufactured products, but also for the agricultural products that, that we also ship, whether it's the grains or whether it's the finished products. And in fact, at World Dairy Expo, there was a seminar that the Livestock Exporters Association provided to a number of Wisconsin exporters. And one of the representatives from EXIM Bank in Chicago was there presenting to the group, talking about those products, as they call them, those guarantees, so that the exporters can actually utilize that to provide credit terms. Because in many markets, the cost of capital is very high. And so rather than provide, let's say, a price discount to compete with some other exporter from another country, if you're able to offer credit terms, that's actually worth more to the customer than a discount on the products to be able to allow them to pay, let's say, in 60 or 90 or 120 days, but also guarantee that you'll get paid for that product, because you can make the export, but if you don't get paid for it, it's not really an export, or it's not a benefit, at least.
Right. We only have a few moments left here, but what more would you like to see Wisconsin lawmakers do to increase exports in the next session?
Well, we really appreciate what has been done to date. I mean, we look at this unprecedented amount of funding that's been available to us from the state. We've not had program funding from the state previously since we began in 1966. So I think to continue that, And they are, this is a 5-year horizon on this program. So we need to go every year to request the funding. But we've had now, we're into our second fiscal year. We just had a few months of fiscal 22 to do that first round. Second round is in now. So to continue that, I think, is one of the most important and beneficial things that we can do to help those exporters grow their business and to bring new exporters into to the market, to the ability to be able to do this.
Getting a toehold. Mark, thank you for joining us.
Really appreciate the opportunity and hope to talk to you soon.
Mark Rodehage, Director of the International Agribusiness Center. This is the State Capital Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Despite being seen as a vulnerable swing state, incumbent Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson has embraced controversy in his bid for re-election this year. And with the help of millions of dollars from Republican donors and groups, he's also relentlessly attacked Democratic challenger Mandela Barnes. As Rich Kramer reports, there are signs the approach may be working.
There are different ways to run campaigns in a 50-50 state like Wisconsin. There's the cautious approach, and then there's the one being taken by Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. During a recent gathering of a couple hundred Republicans at a Racine County Fairgrounds pavilion, Johnson delivers what sounds momentarily like a typical swing state speech. He calls for unity, and he says Republicans want to heal the nation.
Aren't you getting tired of the division and the anger?
But Johnson quickly pivots. He accuses Democrats of purposely driving up the cost of gas to force people into electric vehicles. He blames Democrats for inflation, saying it amounts to stealing people's savings. And he says progressives, like Democratic challenger Mandela Barnes, want to change the country because they don't like it.
This fundamental transformation of America is fundamentally destroying this country. We got to save it. These people have to be stopped.
The crowd at this rally feeds off of Johnson's remarks. Rich Strom, a Republican living near Burlington, says he likes that Johnson stands up for what he believes.
He's not your ordinary politician. He's a successful businessman, and he doesn't give the politically correct answers all the time. He does state things the way they are.
The list of Johnson's controversial statements is long. In just the past couple years, he has frustrated public health officials when he repeatedly questioned the safety of the COVID-19 vaccine. Republican Mary Lacomey of Union Grove says she agrees with Johnson.
He's been behind the COVID stuff. I think he's really gotten behind the people that have been, say, vaccine injured or worse.
Johnson has also downplayed the violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. And recently, text messages came to light showing Johnson's office tried to deliver slates of fake electors to former Vice President Mike Pence the day of January 6th. Former Democratic State Senate Majority Leader Chuck Koala says Johnson's involvement in the fake election scheme shows he's an enabler of Republicans pushing for autocracy.
He is not the one strategizing to make it happen, but he will help them make it happen. And that is a terrible danger for our democracy.
Johnson's controversial approach has worn thin with some Wisconsin voters based on years of polling by the Marquette University Law School. In recent years, a growing number of voters have held a negative view of Johnson. But Scott Jensen, a Republican lobbyist and former Speaker of the Wisconsin Assembly, says favorability ratings aren't the only thing that win elections.
Ron Johnson may not be able to improve his numbers, but he can dramatically reduce Mandela Barnes' numbers.
A Marquette poll in August showed Barnes leading Johnson by 7 percentage points among likely voters. But after Republicans spent tens of millions of dollars attacking Barnes for being soft on crime, that lead disappeared.
I think some of the early post-primary polling was too friendly to Barnes.
That's Jessica Taylor, the Senate and Governor's editor for the Cook Political Report.
Sources I talked to and my own analysis was that this was never going to be a 7-point race or something. Wisconsin is just too close for that, that this is going to be a 51-49, 52-48 race.
Several recent polls have showed Johnson leading Barnes, though the race remains tight. Taylor says the attacks on Barnes have been so successful that even if people dislike Johnson, there will be some who vote for him anyway. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And Wisconsin Public Radio will have a story tomorrow about Senator Johnson's Democratic challenger, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. Now it is the State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We hear from an independent state agency that is federally charged with serving as a resource to all branches of state government on disability issues. We look at policy priorities, the budget request, pressing issues before the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities, and how this board is giving voice to this community statewide. Join in with questions, your experiences, 800-642-1234. Beth Swedeen is Executive Director of the State Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. Beth, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
So, Beth, explain in your words, what is the role of your agency?
Sure. There's a border council like this in every state and territory in the country, and it is a part of the Developmental Disabilities Act that's about 50 years old now. We're celebrating our 50th anniversary.
Yes.
And our board is made up, thank you, our board is made up of people living with developmental disability and their family members, as well as some reps from state agencies. The folks living with disability with lived experience are appointed by the governor. They are really charged with looking at the pressing issues facing the disability community in Wisconsin and then advocating for change as well as coming up with innovative solutions.
How did you make your way to this board?
I made my way like a lot of folks with lived experience. I have a daughter who's now an adult with a developmental disability.
And over the past half century of this board, what has dramatically improved for the disability community and what has stayed the same or even worsened?
Sure. So many things have changed in the last 50 years. When you think of, the 1960s and 70s, the majority of people with developmental disabilities across the country were still living in state institutions. So they were kind of out of sight, out of mind. We didn't have the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. So many children with disabilities were not participating in their public schools. And there were long wait lists for services. Even programs like Birth to Three, which are early intervention programs, were just in their infancy, and a lot of them were started by families in church basements. So fast forward now to children living and participating in their public schools, recognition of the importance of early intervention and early diagnosis to have people maximize their lives, and then, just a really strong self-determination and self-advocacy movement where people with disabilities are speaking their truth. They're leaders in their communities. They are participating in work and in community life and are talking about their experiences and helping shape policy by being at the table.
Let's look at one of the barriers, which is caregiving. And you co-chair the Survival Coalition of Wisconsin Disability Organizations. The coalition released a survey of nearly 500 caregivers recently. What are the major findings?
Mm-hmm. So as you may know, we have pretty extensive programs in the state funded by Medicaid. They're called long-term care programs. And they we are one of the few states in the country that have ended our wait lists. But the new emerging issue that has really stymied pretty much every part of the country is the lack of caregivers, of people who are available and willing to work in these jobs to support folks in their homes and communities. So our survey looked at the folks who are bearing, you know, the lion's share of the challenge on that, and that's family caregivers. Because every time you can't hire or retain a care worker, that care need does not go away. And so families are stepping in, oftentimes extended families stepping in, and they're doing those supports to make sure that their loved ones are safe and healthy. So it's a huge issue. I think COVID has only exacerbated it because as we've seen, you know, the labor pool shrink and wages go up in other fields. This is a field where wages are stagnant. That I think the average care worker across the country is making under $13 an hour at a time that Target and Culver's are hiring folks at $16 and $17 an hour. So it's a huge issue. And in states like Wisconsin that have increasingly aging populations, we have more and more need for caregivers every year, and then a smaller labor pool at the same time of folks in that younger age range who are able to provide those supports.
Something that stuck out on the survey, families providing 80% of care for children and adults with disabilities and older adults. That right there, the family itself is a major workforce, if you will, which can have huge financial implications on that particular family. Can you explain what could go on there?
Sure, because we did ask questions to that point about how is this impacting, you know, you as a worker and as a person, as well as your family. This is an issue that's reaching into every single community in Wisconsin, and not just impacting the individual family, but also the economy of every area, every county, every community. We found and quantified in our survey that two-thirds of caregivers have said they either had to reduce their hours of work or have left the workforce entirely. So as you mentioned, that means obviously less purchasing power and less financial stability for that family unit. But it also means, you know, fewer people in the workforce at a time when Wisconsin's unemployment rate is very, very low and employers are begging for skilled workers. And these are usually skilled workers. These are folks, you know, who are well into their careers. They're oftentimes capable of leadership roles in their careers. And they're saying, sorry, I have to work, you know, a part-time job, or I can only work virtually, or I have to find something that fits the few hours a day I can work. And so the impact, and it's creeping up every year more extensively, the impact on the community is not just on that family unit, but on the entire economic, you know, vitality of every community in Wisconsin.
Let me ask you this, because there's been this pipeline program in recent years to train up certified nursing assistants, CNAs. Mm-hmm. And since 2018, the WISC Caregiver Careers Program has trained thousands of CNAs in our state. Do you feel there needs to be a standalone caregiver program to address the needs that you're seeing?
Oh, that's such a great question. And actually, our Department of Health Services is actually developing that program with ARPA funds right now. And I do think, and we all agree, it's one of the critical pieces to the puzzle to attract people, to help them understand that this is a really rewarding career. But unfortunately, the pay and the opportunities after that entry level are just not meeting the standard of what you and I would consider a profession. So there's really a lot of work to be done around just basic wages and rate reform in long-term care programs, as well as some of the other things you're talking about as far as recruitment and training.
So you're saying that the Federal American Rescue Plan Act funding is helping to put together this type of pipeline program, because, you know, the current state budget includes an additional $100 million for caregivers.
Right. That is correct. The state of Wisconsin has chosen, through the Department of Health Services leadership, has chosen to invest quite a bit of that funding in training and equipping caregivers.
Beth Swedeen with us leads the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. It's an independent agency seeking ways to improve the lives of people with developmental disabilities. has an eye on all systems of state government. Join in on advocacy work. Join in on programs that improve the lives of adults and children with developmental disabilities. Challenges you encounter as a family and the breakthroughs. 800-642-1234. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. Executive Director Beth Swedeen is here. This independent agency is marking 50 years, as we talked about, advocating on behalf of Wisconsin's disability community. Federal law established in state statute in 1972. Their conference, called Self-Determination, is set for next week. Join in on the programs, the services, advocacy work, 800-642-1234. And Beth Swedeen stays with us. Let's take a call now. Mary is with us from New London. Mary, hi, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My concern has been just finding paid support staff for our adult son who has an intellectual disability. Noah's 25 years old. He lives with us currently. And even if we were able to find some independent housing for him, we wouldn't be able to help him move in because he needs care. He needs somebody to be with him 24/7. And right now, we consider ourselves lucky if we can find somebody for about 30 hours a week. Our current son's current caregiver can't work too many hours because then she risks losing medical benefits for her children. Our son, we signed our son up for a camp session, hoping that we could have a couple weeks of respite care, my husband and I, this summer. And the camp got canceled after 24 hours because of COVID. We've worked with an agency, and it's like a revolving door. Somebody comes in for a few days, and then they find another job. Because honestly, who can live these days and support a family on $14 an hour with no health benefits or paid time off?
Mary, thank you so much for bringing your personal situation. Beth, go ahead. What would you tell her?
Yeah, Mary is saying what we hear over and over throughout the state, and she's spot on around just how tightly controlled families' lives are, that they really cannot leave, go on a vacation, do the typical things. And then you're always on high alert, right? You're always right by your cell phone because something's going to break down. And I think she's pointing to some of the really important reforms that Wisconsin needs to think about, which is not just a rate reform in the hourly rates that workers are paid that really reflects the true cost of care, which is not $14 an hour or $12 an hour. It's much higher. But also the fact that so many caregivers don't have benefits. They don't have health insurance. They don't have paid time off. If a person gets sick, like Mary's son gets sick, the caregiver knows that they could be called tomorrow and told, sorry, don't come in for your 6-hour shift. And then they don't get paid for that shift. So we need to be thinking about building in health insurance, paid time off. She talks about, the limits. We have almost 50% of our caregivers, paid caregivers in the state, who are on public health insurance because their wages are so low and they're trying to support families. So we are supportive of income disregards that could disregard a certain percentage of a caregiver's income so that they could still qualify for health insurance benefits, public health insurance benefits. So she's speaking to some of the really important reforms that we need if we're really going to get a handle on this problem. Otherwise, we're going to see more and more people doing what Mary's doing, which is keeping their adult children at home. So those adults are not getting the full life that they really want to have. And then as, aging caregivers become more incapacitated, what's going to happen then? There will not be anyone to step in.
Where should Mary turn to next? Do you have any suggestions?
Well, I mean, you can call the typical places in your county, but I know that Mary and other families know what they're going to hear. So because you can get a worker through the 35-page application process and all signed up, and then, you know, Target offers another $2 an hour and your worker is gone. So, or even a really committed worker, like that sounds like the one Mary has, she's got to think about raising her own children and what wages will actually pay for her to be able to support her family. So, you know, I think we have to turn to, and this is the State Capitol Report, we have to turn to our legislature and our state and our governor and say, it's time to invest in true rate reform. It's time to quit nibbling around the edges on this issue and to get very serious about supporting caregiving at the rates that it deserves. And just to give you a number, in our state, private pay right now for under 3 hours at a time is $50 an hour. And the most that the state can pay through Medicaid, which is set by the state, is $21.84 an hour. Now, that never goes straight to the worker. That goes to the agency that employs the worker, and the agency has to take off their cut. And that's why you're seeing wages at typically $12 to $15 an hour for that worker.
Beth Swedeen with us, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. You can join in 800-642-1234. Beth, your board also provides training that includes informing caregivers and people needing care about their legal and civil rights. Can you explain a little bit about the training work?
Sure. We do a lot of work to really empower people with developmental disabilities and help them make informed decisions with appropriate supports, as well as speaking out and speaking up for themselves. We have a federal grant right now called Living Well that really focuses on individual rights and helping people understand their rights. You may know that people with developmental disabilities are at 7 times the national average for abuse and neglect. So we are very concerned about vulnerabilities, and especially when folks don't know what their rights are. And what we're finding is that with support and training and education on who to go to for support, that makes a huge difference in people's standing up and talking about things that are happening that may not be okay for them. So we do a lot of work with that. And as you referenced with our self-determination conference, we're expecting probably almost 900 people between virtual and in-person next week at the Dells, Kalahari, talking about self-determination. So, you know, working where you want to work, living where you want to live, speaking up, voting rights. We do a lot of work in the voting area as well. So just everything around, and what we find is with opportunity and with informed information and the right supports, people, even people with the most significant developmental disabilities, can really change the course on their life and be much more independent and much more safe.
Beth, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. This was a wonderful opportunity, and I really appreciate it. Family caregiving is a top issue in our state, and I appreciate you shining a light on it.
Sure. Beth Swedeen, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.